sitting there thinking, and couldn't help but think about Revelation chapter 5, verse 9, as I now look over this audience, think about all the people from every tongue, tribe, nation that make up heaven, that seemingly make up this congregation. And it is so with great appreciation that I stand before you, having been asked by my good friend Tim. I've known Tim Byers for 44 years. We first met in college. I was four years old at the time. I'm not sure how old Tim was. But that's about the same time you started here, wasn't it? About 44, 45 years ago. Good to see John, known him over the years. I have with me this morning my wife Martha and my youngest daughter Molly, my oldest son David, and his wife Michelle. The Sotos from Southside, Pasadena, have come to be with us also. And my nephew and his family, Stephen, have come down from the Woodlands. It's the Woodlands, not a woodland, not just Woodlands. It's the Woodlands. So let's make sure that you always get that. I tell people now I'm from the Athens of the Alabama. But it'll certainly be great to be with you. This man here is a guy by the name of G.K. Chesterton. Maybe some of you have heard about him. He was known as the greatest theologian of the early 1900s. He was nicknamed the Prince of Paradox because he liked to use popular sayings and proverbs and allegories to make his arguments. It shouldn't come as any surprise to us that he was a big fan of fairy tales, of all things. He once wrote this about fairy tales. He said, fairy tales are more than true, not because they tell us about dragons exist, but because they tell us that dragons can be beaten. And his favorite fairy tale of all was the fairy tale Beauty and the Beast. That novel was first written and published in 1740. Later it was taken and condensed somewhat and made into a children's story. But probably we are more familiar with the two Disney movies, aren't we, that were made, called Beauty and the Beast. And if you remember the movies, you remember there was this young prince and a good-looking guy. And one evening, an old beggar lady shows up at the castle, and she's hungry and she's freezing. But he turns her away, doesn't provide any hospitality whatsoever, no compassion, no love. Little denotes to him, though, that this old lady was, in fact, an enchantress. She placed a spell upon him, upon his castle, turning him into a beast. Well, for the next hour and a half, there's a lot of singing and dancing going on. But at the end of the movie, as the beast lays dying from a wound, Belle confesses her love for him, kisses him, and releases him from the curse. And everything's back to the way it once was. Here's what Chesterton said about that particular fairy tale. He said, the unlovely must be deeply loved before they become lovable. Someone treated like an animal will become an animal. Someone treated with worth, dignity, and beauty as a human being will become a human being. Now, he went on from there. He said, in fact, Beauty and the Beast is, in fact, the story of Jesus Christ. He likened this to what Christ did during his ministry on this world. Now, when you think about the ministry of Christ, what's the things that pop into your mind? Is it about all the places that he visited? Well, he visited a lot of places, didn't he? Is it about all the sermons that he preached? Well, he preached quite a few sermons. Is it about all the miracles that he did? Well, he did a lot of miracles, didn't he? But let me tell you this. The ministry of Jesus Christ was about his outreach to the outcast, to the unlovely, the unhealthy, to those people that society would just cast off. And what did he do? Well, he touched them. He healed them. He forgave them of their sins. He restored the dignity that they were missing. And sometimes he exorcised the demons that tormented them. It is the exercising of demons that I want to talk about with you this morning. Our text will come from Luke chapter 8. Luke chapter 8, we'll talk about on one of these occasions where Christ exorcise some demons here. It says in Luke chapter 8 and verse 26 that Christ and his apostles have come to the country of the Gadarenes. Now that area is on the southeast part of there, the Sea of Galilee. And when Christ arrives at this area there, it said that he's met by a naked man who was demon-possessed. Now, in Matthew's account, there were two men that were demon-possessed, but Luke and Mark only talk about one, so we'll talk about the one here. But of all the instances that we have of Christ and him exercising demons from those individuals that he came across, this is probably the most familiar of all, isn't it? This demon-possessed man here in Luke chapter 8. This man who lived amongst the tombs. But I'll tell you what this represents to me. It is really a perfect illustration of what happens to a person who lets sin into their lives. And the reaction that we see from man and what we see from Christ. And then we find out how Jesus wants that person who's been exorcised of sin, what he wants them to do. So what we're going to talk about, the outside, we're going to talk about the inside, and we're going to talk about the upside as it relates to this instance here in Luke chapter 8 with this demon-possessed man. Now let's first talk about the outside. Look in the text there. This man, for all practical purposes, this man was the boogeyman. He had been terrorizing those people for a number of years now. He had been wreaking havoc upon that community. And all they knew what to do was to chain him up, to get some chains on him in some way, and try to in some way curb his mischief. That's all they could think of, how they could deal with this man here. But the chains couldn't hold him, could they? We know from Mark chapter 5, verse 34, that he broke the chains every time they chained him up. And he continued to terrorize those people of that region. The only type of thing, the only solution they had to this man was to bring some type of external pressure upon him to keep him under control. And that's exactly what we try to do today when we come across people that are just bent on evil, that are just bent on doing all sorts of terrible sins. It was December the 14th of 2012. 20-year-old Adam Lansing entered Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, with one thing on his mind that morning: to kill as many people as he could. And when he was through, 20 children ages 6 to 7 lay dead and 6 adults. When first responders got to the scene, Lansing shot himself in the head. That community and our nation was shocked, weren't we? You remember that? Sandy Hook Elementary School is still the deadliest mass shooting at a school in America to date. But it wasn't very long after that, in fact, the same day for some folks, that they started claiming what we need most in this country to stop things like this, what we need most is gun control. Well, the media, the politicians, the Hollywood, everybody, what we need is more gun control, more external pressures to stop things like this. More chains. That's what they were advocating. If we can just bring on more external pressure, you see. But folks, there's already laws in the books that says you ought not kill somebody. There's already gun laws on the books. That seemingly didn't stop anybody from killing others, does it? So will taking away all the guns end mass murders? Well, some people believe it will. But should we take away all cars at the same time? Last September, we walked over a bridge in London where just a few months before, a man ran over folks and killed them. A murderer. And so is the solution to being killed by cars to take away all cars? Well, maybe so. Or how about knives? You know, this past spring in Japan, some lunatic got into a school there and stabbed 16 young children there. Two eventually died. Should we take away all knives in, you see? Or how about baseball bats? You know, people kill others with baseball bats sometimes. How about hammers? How about your hands? You know, you can strangle somebody to death with your hand. You see what I'm getting at? The only solution sometimes we have in this world to curb what is wrong, what we find is violent, is more external pressures, more laws. Thinking that's going to solve the problem. Edmund Burke was a lot of things. And one of those things was he was a philosopher. And here's what he said on one occasion. He said, society cannot exist unless a controlling power upon will and appetite be placed somewhere, and the less of it there is within, the more there must be without. Amen. That's exactly what's happening, isn't it? You know what that controlling power was for so many people for so long in our nation and even other parts of the world? That controlling power was Christianity. That controlling power was Christian. It was Christ. A belief in His Word. A respect for what He has to say. That we ought to love God and we ought to love our neighbor, and thus we don't go out and kill our neighbor. That was the controlling power that we had so, that was so prevalent in our society. But we got to get rid of Jesus, don't we? We got to get rid of any idea of Christianity. And what do we do then? We got to replace it with more laws. That's what we've got to do. Get rid of that. And tell me, how's that been working out for us here in our nation? Not very good, has it? Let's be honest. We are in a mess. And we didn't get to this mess overnight. This has been something that's been going on for centuries. In fact, probably three centuries in the making. In the mess that we've got today. It's been a steady, constant progression. Downward. It started back in the 18th century. Where people tried to kill the Bible. They were called deists. Well, a deist believes in God and believes that there is greater. He just doesn't believe that God left some type of special revelation for man. And so, the Bible, you see, it's just a book. It's not from God. It's not some type of revelation to me or to you. And so they tried to kill the Bible back in the 18th century. In the 19th century, they killed God. See, they replaced the Creator with survival of the fittest. Or might makes right. And so people who bought into that type of stuff, you see. People like Friedrich Nietzsche, who come on and coined the phrase, God is dead. Killed God. And that brings us to the 20th century and the 21st century. And in this century, they've killed man. Because you got enough people who believed in what Darwin and others had to say and got that into their heads and thinking, well, you know what? I must be some type of superhuman that I can in some way express my will and people need to follow me. You know, there was a little paper hanger from Austria that bought into that type of stuff by the name of Adolf Hitler. And you think of all the disaster and death associated with that guy. You know, there were more people killed in the 20th century by man than all centuries before that put together. That's amazing, isn't it? And now we've come to the 21st century. And it hadn't stopped, has it? It's even got worse. And now we've got people coming to going to the streets and applauding killing children. Well, that used to be a shameful thing. Even those who agree with that type of idea were in some way shamed by it, but there's no more shame about that, isn't it? They proudly march in the streets that want to kill our children. They'll celebrate that. And the person who dares stand up and says, wait a minute, what are you thinking? What are you doing? There's something wrong with that person, isn't it? And we wonder where we're at and how we got there. See, the only thing that man can ever come up with is some type of outward type of restraint. Where we are a God-starved society. And what this world doesn't need is more chains. It needs more Christ. More of His Word. Only Jesus can change the hearts of people, not politicians. I'm here to tell you. It's only Jesus. And I think that's made evident by what we see here in Luke chapter 8. Christ has come now to this place where all they could consider themselves and all they could think of was, let's chain him. Jesus shows up and he's going to deal with the inside. If you notice there in Luke chapter 8, the first thing that Jesus does not say is that, you know what, the problem with you folks is you don't have strong enough chains. You know, or you don't have enough chains. He doesn't say that, does he? Jesus is going to deal with the inside of this man before, because we know from Matthew chapter 15, verse 19, for out of the heart proceeds evil thoughts, murders, adultery, all the way through there. Out of the heart, you've got to deal with the inward man. And that's exactly what Christ does. Christ exorcises the demons from this man here. And this man, the boogeyman now, becomes the best dressed, the best behaved person in that entire region. Who'd ever thought it? And people come out to where Jesus is. And there's that man that had terrorized him for so long, sitting at the foot of Christ, clothed and in his right mind. And you would think there would be a cheer that you could hear all the way down to Jerusalem. But I want you to look at the reaction that those people have there in Luke chapter 8. Look there in verse 35. It says, they were afraid. Afraid? Why would you be afraid? This man now is acting right. He's acting the way that you want it. They were afraid. Now, why is that? Well, I think if you read on, if you take in account some of the other places that we find this account here, it gives us the answer. Verse 36, Luke chapter 8. It says, they also who had seen it told them by what means he who had been demon-possessed was healed. All right, that's what we find in Luke. Over in Matthew's account, Matthew chapter 8, verse 33, here's what Matthew says. And I think this is interesting. And I think this lets on to us why they were so afraid. It says, then those who kept them fled, it said, and they went into the city and told everything, including what had happened to the demon-possessed man. Now, if you understand what's happened here, the people that saw what had happened ran back into the city and told the others there in the city, the first thing was this. Hey, you know those hogs out there? They're all dead now. Oh, and by the way, the guy that's been terrorizing us for so long, he's okay. That's kind of how I read Matthew chapter 8 here. That the most important thing on their mind at this time here was the property that had been destroyed. And yeah, about that guy, yeah, he's okay now. And they were afraid. Now the question I would have, why does Jesus allow the destruction of the swine here in this? You know, he didn't have to do that, but he allows it, doesn't he? You know, I'd ask the same question. Why does he tell the rich young ruler there in Luke chapter 18, verse 22, to go and sell everything he had? You know, he never told anybody else to do that, but why does he tell that man? Well, of course, the reason why is because Christ knew what was inside that rich young ruler. He knew that was most important to him was money. And so, to get him straight, he had to get rid of those things that was most important to him. Why does Jesus allow the death of these hogs here in this instance? Because that was the most important thing in their minds, in their hearts. And the best way to bring out what was in them was to allow the destruction of what was considered most precious. And so, if that meant that some pigs had to die, then they had to die, didn't they? Getting our hearts right with Jesus needs to be changed first by getting rid of what we are so attached to. You know, when I look at this story here in Luke chapter 8, I wonder if those demons, and it says in the text that they called them to legion. There seemingly was many demons there. And when Christ first told them to leave, they wouldn't leave. They asked Christ, here, is it all right if we can go into the swine? Now, just don't send us off here. Can we go into the swine? And Jesus said, okay, you can do that. Yeah, you can go into the swine. And I wonder if those demons are kind of chuckling to themselves here, thinking that you know, they pull one over on Jesus here. He's going to let us go. So he's not going to send us out into the abyss somewhere. He's going to let us go into the swine. But folks, when your last audible noise is an oink, the joke's on you. And that's exactly what Christ did. He sent him into the swine, didn't he? They went running off the cliff there, and they're all destroyed. And folks, that's how Jesus made devil ham that morning. You wonder where that stuff comes from. There's where it comes from. Christ dealt with the inside. They dealt with the outside. And now Jesus is going to deal with the upside with this man here. The people asked Jesus to leave. Now, you know, we shouldn't be too hard on them for asking Christ to leave. You know, when you're faced with a with a supernatural presence, and probably you're fearful of that, aren't you? And the first inclination is you want to get him away from you in some way. I kind of liken this to if they want to come and build a nuclear plant over here, a block away from here. Would y'all like that? Probably not, even though you know the benefits of that, but you're more fearful perhaps about it blowing up and things that might happen with that. And so here are these people that are faced with Christ here. You know, Luke talks about over in Luke chapter 5 there about Peter on one occasion. He was faced with the power of Christ, and he asked Jesus to leave. The Gadarenes asked Christ to leave their country. The man begs Jesus, "Let me go with you." And Jesus says, no, he says in verse 39, "Return to your own house and tell what great things God has done for you." He said, "I'm going to leave you behind. You're going to be my testimony of my power and what good I did for you." And so Christ leaves, and he leaves the man behind. Now, how's that work out? Does this man do as Christ had asked him to do? Well, let's read on here. Look over in Mark chapter 7. In Mark chapter 7, Christ is going to come back to this very region here, Mark chapter 7. And it says down there in verse 31, it says, "Again, departing from the region of Tyre and Sidon, he came through the midst of the region of Decapolis to the Sea of Galilee." Now, Decapolis is what the Romans called this region here. And it says in verse 32 of Mark chapter 7, "They brought to him one who was deaf and had an impediment in his speech, and they begged him to put his hands on him." And so Christ heals the man. And then in verse 36, 37, it says, "Then he commanded them that they should tell no one, but the more he commanded them, the more widely they proclaimed it, and they were astonished beyond measure, saying, he has done all things well." The very people who had told Jesus, "Please leave our area, please go away from here," are now welcoming Jesus, and they couldn't get enough of Jesus. I think that demon-possessed man did his job, didn't he? I think he shared the upside of what Christ can do to someone's life if you just let him in. You know, sometimes we get nervous about people talking about testimonials. And I'll be honest, I don't know if I particularly like that word, testimonial. But you know what? The concept behind that is found throughout the New Testament. What does Jesus tell his apostles there in Acts chapter 1? "I want you to be a witness of me. I want you to, in essence, testify of me and what I've done and what you've seen and what's happened in your life." We know on two occasions during the book of Acts, Paul gives a testimony of what had happened in his life. And we know that over in Peter, what does Peter say? 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. "Always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear." What better way to convince somebody of Christ than to show them through your life what he's done for you? And folks, I've seen some amazing transitions and changes that have happened in people's lives. People that were all wrapped up in sin, who came out of that because of Christ. And that's a powerful testimony to anybody else who says, "Oh, I can never change, I can never get out of this." No, you can. Because Jesus has left us example after example that it can happen. He left a formerly demon-possessed man there in that region to testify the power that he had. And I dare say that man probably never stopped talking about Jesus till the day he died. I doubt if anybody knows this little girl right here. Her name is Anna Green. Anna Green, along with 19 other little children, died on December the 12th of 14th of 2012 at Sandy Hook Elementary School. What a tragic death. But you know what? Anna and her classmates, they're all right. They never lived a day away from Jesus. And now they live with Him. But I dare say that most of us in here are over the age of 6. And probably not all of us in here have turned to Jesus and say, "Jesus, save me. Jesus, cleanse me. Make me different. Make me your child." And so as we bring to a close this sermon, I want to offer an invitation to anybody who needs to do that, that needs to change a life that's been outside of Christ to one that you now live inside Jesus. We can help you do that this morning as we sing this invitation song. Why don't you make that known to us now as we stand and we sing.